I used my newsletter column this month to point out how all over the place the term biblical values is. Some of you may have had a chance to read some of that, some not. I'm going to lead off with some little expanded version of that today. After doing an online Google search on the term biblical values, I discovered that I could have spent the next couple of days, had I been so inclined, checking out all the websites and all the other references that came up. Well, I was not so inclined, so I limited myself to two organizations instead, which could not have been further apart when it came to their appealing to biblical values to make their respective cases. The first such organization is called Americans for Biblical Values. Their stated objective is to save our country from, quote, the plague of liberalism. This plague involves such things as abortion, drug abuse, rising divorce rates, and, of course, their marquee issue of a greater acceptance of homosexuality and same-sex marriage, neither of which they like. In fact, they don't like any of that, and they lump it all in together and sort of put it under this heading of a plague of liberalism. They go on to state on this website, the only proven answer to the decline in America that we have experienced in the last 50 years can be found in restoring biblical values in our personal lives, families, and nation. Now, just what the phrase only proven answer meant wasn't too clear to me, but for persons in sympathy with this group's overall drift, which is mainly to rescue this country from the plague of liberalism, I guess the phrase was clear enough. Well, then I moved along. Did a little more cruising around all these websites that were up there, and I found one called Clergy for Fairness. Now, this group was initially organized to oppose the Federal Marriage Act of 2006. Some of you may remember that. This was an act to amend the United States Constitution so as to define marriage as only between a man and a woman. The proposed amendment was in time defeated by the United States House of Representatives, and it got no further. And the Clergy for Fairness people, on their website, also appealed to biblical values in making their case. They claimed that the true biblical values were the ones that we just heard read, ones that embrace faith, hope, and love, as stated in the New Testament book of Corinthians. This principle, it was further maintained, can and should be applied to a wide range of relationships, including same-sex ones, that persons of faith and goodwill should affirm and promote. And among the various religious organizations, they had this list of all the religious bodies that were supporting their appeal. Among those was our own Unitarian Universalist Association. So I look at those websites and I thought, well, what do you make of a situation where appeals to biblical values are coming from diametrically opposite ends of the social values and religious values spectrum? Well, my first temptation is to simply say, since this phrase, biblical values, can be stretched so far in such completely different directions that it really has no operative value at all, we should just get rid of it. Discard it. Tempted to do that, I say. I don't quite go there. I don't because there's no escaping the reality that the Bible, with its Hebraic scripture, also known as the Old Testament, and the writings of the first and second century church, also known as the New Testament, that this document is one of the foundational documents of Western civilization. Foundational, however, does not mean infallible. It does mean that some of the Bible stories, narratives, images, metaphors, maxims, and sayings, along with its broad range of moral and ethical teachings, are part of our cultural lexicon. They're part of the language that we speak, often without our being aware of. There probably any day doesn't go by, whether you're conscious of it or not, use some kind of expression that has some kind of a root or some kind of an origin in the Bible. And while I was raised in a religious environment where, with just a little bit of wriggle room, the Bible was taken literally, I have now come to view it and respect it as a series of writings that's to be treated kind of like you would treat the Iliad, the Odyssey, the works of Shakespeare, the Magna Carta, or closer to home, our own American Declaration of Independence or the Gettysburg Address, and that's the short list. What I'm trying to put on that list is just stuff that I think it's good to be familiar with. Familiar with if you're going to be reasonably literate and reasonably knowledgeable when it comes to the culture that we live in and the history, for better and for worse, that got us here. And it is also true that much of the codes of Western law and morality draw upon on some of the broad moral themes expressed in the Bible, themes and ideals that actually transcend the wording of those particular verses. So all in all, I think that we religious liberals would ignore the Bible or give it away to the religious right at our peril. I think we need to be a part of a larger cultural conversation with our own perspective on the Bible, and that's the perspective I want to share for the next several minutes. For Okers, the Bible should be read as a collection of writings composed over the course of nearly 1,000 years by an unknown number of writers, some of those writers unknown as well. They were writers with varying theologies, varying opinions, varying worldviews, and varying religious and political agendas. Roughly about the first third of the Old Testament, for example, comes from court documents written in the early years of the Israeli monarchy in order to give that fledgling Near Eastern kingdom a theocratic, that is to say, Yahweh-based history. Now, the court scribes who were doing this kind of composing, it wasn't so much that they were just making stuff up. They may have done a little bit of that here and there. But mostly, they were drawing upon the tribal legends and stories and myths that the tribal people who eventually came to make up the nation of Israel had been hearing for generations by way of an oral tradition. Now, the scribes gave these stories and legends a certain spin, of course. They were, after all, working for the king. But some good and instructive stories did come out of that process. So the Bible contains, among other things, a rather heady mix of mythology, legend, somewhat reliable history, poetry, prophetic social justice writings, letters, philosophical essays, apocalyptic scenarios, you name it, it's probably there. In the case of the New Testament, what you have are the documents and letters and other writings of the first and second century Christian church, which were later deemed to be canonical scripture. All right, I probably haven't said anything so far that's really going to set anybody off. In fact, I've probably been preaching to the choir, or the greater choir in this case, up to this point. But I would just point out that in the setting in which I was raised, what I have just said would be considered heresy, if not demeaning and degrading, since I would be accused of making of the Bible a mere human doctrine. What I've come to see is that to say that the Bible was written by mere human beings within a certain span of human history is really no more demeaning than saying Beethoven's Ode to Joy was composed by a mere mortal, or that Da Vinci's Mona Lisa was painted by a mere mortal, or that Shakespeare's Hamlet was written by a mere mortal. Each of these is a magnificent and inspired work of music and art and literature, respectively. And yes, some works of music and art and literature are certainly more inspired than others, just as some works of music, art, and literature are kind of downright bad. And the same goes for the Bible. Some parts of it are magnificent and inspired, and other parts, as I hope to point out in a few minutes here, are downright horrendous. On the magnificent side, let's start with that. On the magnificent side, there is the eloquent and still timely rhetoric of the Hebrew prophet Amos that I cited in my Martin Luther King sermon a few weeks ago, where Amos has the Hebrew God saying, "Let justice roll down like waters, righteousness like a mighty stream." There's the prophet Micah declaring, "What does the Lord require of thee? But to do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with thy God." I know that theology may not resonate with some of us, but what better set of values? What better set of principles? Biblical values and principles, if you will, can there be for living than that? Do justice. Love mercy. Walk humbly through life upon this earth. Kind of hard to improve on that. And then there are the not so magnificent parts. For even as the Old Testament or Hebraic scripture gives us this majestic God, love and mercy and justice, it also, in other places, gives us a rather mean and spiteful and small-minded and vengeance-seeking God. Especially in the book of Joshua, where if you read that chapter after chapter, You have God, Yahweh, seeming to take delight in whole villages being destroyed, with men, women, and children being slaughtered in his name. It's really horrible stuff. Some of the Ten Commandments, which generally reflect some of the moral codes of the time in which they were written, contain very sound moral teachings. Don't lie, or cheat, or steal, or kill, or practice infidelity. Biblical values like this will certainly get no argument from me. I try to live by them myself. Of course, they're not just biblical values. They are also sound human values that have emerged and developed over the course of human history. In the form of the Ten Commandments, as we get them in the Bible, they just happen to be couched in a fascinating legend, recorded in the book of Exodus. But the text that contains the Ten Commandments is also intermingled with calls to allegiance to that very same tribal deity to which I just referred, who took delight in some of those conquests. We move to the New Testament. We find the very humane teachings of Jesus in the Beatitudes he offered to the downtrodden of his day, as a way of bringing some measure of hope, some degree of dignity to their lives. Talk about blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are you. Blessed are these people. The people he was referring to were the people in their society, in their culture, who were feeling anything but blessed. He was trying to raise their spirits and lift them a bit. We see his many acts of healing the sick and the oppressed, however one wishes to interpret these accounts. As avowed an atheist, as the late writer and essayist Kurt Vonnegut was, he was never shy about pointing out that his moral compass was grounded in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Vonnegut was also a self-described, proclaimed Unitarian Christian. But then alongside these worthy teachings of Jesus, we also have, in the New Testament book of Revelation, the conquering Christ, who is out to destroy the enemies of God and cast them into the lake of fire as the world comes to an end. My own opinion here is that if Jesus of Nazareth could have actually read the book of Revelation, he would have been somewhere beyond appalled at what had been done to his humble message of love of neighbor and love of God. And then we have the wisdom of St. Paul, including that passage we heard of his about the three greatest human virtues being faith, hope, and love, as cited also by those clergy for fairness people. I can't tell you how many times I have read that passage or heard someone else read it at a wedding. Faith, hope, and love. They're wonderful biblical values. But you can't read Paul without also encountering his loathing of his own body that has left a suspicion of, if not an aversion to, all things fleshy and earthy in the Western world ever since, if not before. Some of the passages that are sort of cherry-picked from the Bible by persons who oppose any kind of civil rights for gay, lesbian persons, I can usually find something Paul said here and there to supposedly back it up. All of this to say that the Bible does have its good and humane values, but it has to be read in a critical and discerning way in order to pull forth the gems of wisdom and the gems of inspiration that are contained within it. To use a metaphor from the text itself, to seriously read the Bible, one has to sort out the wheat from the chaff. And to read it in such a way so as to derive meaning from it and discern its values while also giving it a critical explanation and exploration is entirely consistent with the approach of our Unitarian and Universalist ancestors. You go back several generations, and those of you who were here last Thursday night for that wonderful presentation Bruce took on the Transcendentalists and before them, you go back into our history and you will find that the Bible was, ours was a faith grounded in the Bible originally. But the Bible, as our ancestors insisted, had to be read and understood in the light of human reason. For them, as for us, reason was not viewed as an enemy of the faith, but rather an enhancer of it. Now, in the course of our new history since then, the Bible has moved off center stage, but it's not to be taken off the stage altogether. We have come to revere and to respect a number of the world's sacred texts, as we should, and we should not neglect the one that provided us with our beginnings as a liberal religious movement as well. For contained within the Bible's stories and myths and legends and teachings, poetry, metaphors, are elements that can touch and deepen our lives, inform our human values, and enhance the common life we share on this planet. And perhaps maybe some of those stories were even written just for us, for Unitarian Universalists. If you go back and carefully read first chapters of the book of Genesis, for example, you will discover that Eve was not only the first woman, she was also the first you, I've decided. This is because, in the myth of the so-called forbidden fruit, she chose a quest for knowledge over unquestioning obedience to higher authority. Think about it, it's there. She chose knowledge over blind obedience. She is our ultimate ancestor. So when I look back upon my early inculcation, and yes, my indoctrination in the Bible, I actually do so with very few negative feelings. I guess I was force-fed the Bible as a child and as a teenager. It just didn't feel that way at the time. It was more a matter of my soaking up the local culture. And that was the local culture in which I was being raised, the culture of my home and my church. Well, as I'm sure this sermon indicates, there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. I don't read the Bible now the same way I did then. But as I say, I do read it with respect and attention and curiosity. For I have come to see it as both a highly valuable and a deeply flawed assemblage of records. So I return to the question I posed at the outset. What is a biblical value? It is not one that is specifically linked to an isolated verse or story that can be used as a so-called proof text for whatever opinion or point of view one wishes to substantiate. Appeals to biblical values have been made over time to oppose the abolition of slavery, to oppose women's suffrage, to oppose racial equality, and now to oppose civil rights for gay and lesbian persons. And verses can be found to back up each and every one of those oppositions if you look for them closely enough. And if you just stick with the Old Testament, for example, polygamy is a perfectly good and defensible biblical value, in which a man is allowed to have as many subservient wives as he wishes. King Solomon had 700 of them, so the Bible tells us. The more I think about that, the more it boggles the mind, if that's what it says. Now, when it comes to my approach to biblical values, I do not look so much for specific verses, even as I know I've cited some in this sermon. But what I am primarily looking for, both within and beyond the specifics of the text, is an underlying movement, a slow progression towards a greater understanding of the human good. For viewed in its totality, the Bible actually moves from the very narrow tribal ethics and mores of the ancient Near East to a kind of a wider and more transcendent view of human justice that some of the Hebrew prophets were able to get a glimpse of, and on to the more universal principles of love, care, and compassion that Jesus set forth. And this is true of many, if not most, religions, actually. They each have their stories and their narratives and their myths and their legends that reflect the particular historical and cultural setting out of which they emerged. But then, within each specific religion, we always can find a few people who figured it out, who got it. You can find a few folks who got it that what we really have here in this particular faith of ours is a piece of a much larger story. A story of humanity itself, reaching up towards our highest and our best aspirations. The Hebrew prophets, some of them anyway, understood this. Jesus, by and large, understood this. St. Paul at least got it right to a certain extent. He did get the faith, hope, and love part right. You've got to give him that. And so the biblical values I seek then are ones that transcend the bounds of any particular faith or faith tradition. They are ones that reflect the greater human narrative of men and women trying to live in accordance with what Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. So on this note, the choir is going to help me conclude this sermon now. The selection called Benediction also draws on St. Paul's writings. There's another place where I think he gets it right. Go into the world in peace. Have courage. Hold what is good. Return no one evil for evil. Strengthen the faint-hearted. Support the weak. Honor all beings. These are both good biblical values, and they are universal human values. I commend them to all of us. So the choir is going to sing that through. The title is called Benediction. And I'm going to ask you to join in singing together hymn number 345, With Joy We Claim, The Growing Light.